This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, our monthly show about computers, Computers and You. We take up this topic each month on the third Monday of the month. This month, I invite your questions about computers for Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois. Peter is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the University's Technology Consortium, FAST-3, at the Center for Teaching Excellence. If you've got a question, a comment, or a concern about computers, give us a call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-9455. WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a toll call, you can use the toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Good afternoon. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Here I am on the last full day of winter.
How about that? And it's pretty spring-like out
it
there
is.
For the last day of winter, isn't it? 52 degrees. And
it's about time.
Okay, very good. You know what? We've already got a caller waiting to talk with you.
Well, I guess we should get started.
All right. Line one, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been having something happen lately. I'll be in the middle of doing something, and my screen will just go. The computer shuts itself off, or it just goes. I have to reboot in order to come back, and everything reboots fine, but I'm wondering what might be the cause of something like this.
So does the screen just blanking, or the entire computer? Does a computer shut down, or does a computer stay running, and then you have to manually shut it down?
The computer stays running, and I have to manually shut it down.
So you can't even shut it down with this, and this is a Windows machine?
It is, and I do Alt-Control-Delete, and nothing comes up.
Okay.
I function to change the screen in case it switched over to some other outlet.
So absolutely no response to the keyboard at all, then?
Absolutely not, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, and you have to use the power supply switch, essentially, to press it and hold it or unplug
That's
it
correct.
Or something.
I have to power down to get anything, yes.
The most common cause of that problem is an incompatibility in the drivers for the screen, some software or some device that you've installed. One thing you can check that tells you if the thing is really just completely and totally dead, which it probably is to, when it happens again, just press the numlock key on your keyboard and see if most keyboards have a little numlock light, which
sure does.
Should come on and off as you press that. And if the thing is totally dead, it can't even respond to that. The most common cause I've seen of that has been a driver incompatibility. The problem is, of course, it's too late to figure out which driver it is that causes it once the thing has gone down. Have there been any recent installs of software or hardware on the machine?
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. Verizon wireless phone card. The new Explorer 7, and I did notice that I was opening a web page when it happened the last time. I'm not sure if that has anything, if there's any job incompatibilities or anything like that. But
that would seem, well, certainly anything is possible. What I would suggest, especially if you've just installed, for example, the new card, this is a laptop then?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. I would check and see, and you're running Windows XP?
Yes, I am, Pro.
Okay. And you're completely updated, I presume, as far as all the various Microsoft patches and such.
As updated as the prompting tell me to be, yes.
Okay. I would check with Verizon, since that's the most recent, or the Verizon hardware support, since that's the most recent device that you've installed.
Okay.
Driver incompatibility, a driver is a little bit of software that acts as the go-between between Windows and whatever device you've got, such as a phone card or such as a printer or such as a screen or even a keyboard.
Sure.
And that operates at such a basic level in the computer system that when it fails, it can cause the entire computer system, and there's just no place for it to go. It happens at a level below the error catching, so it can't even pop up a message saying, hey, we've got a problem with this program. It's too fundamental for that. It's not easy to isolate those, but essentially make sure all your drivers are up to date. I had one machine at one point where it was simply a bad connection between, believe it or not, the keyboard and the computer, and so they could sometimes manage to unplug it, plug it back in. Now, it didn't start working right at the time because the machine was already locked up, but rebooting, and it would tend to go for several months before they had to do it again.
Well, at least it's better than a sticky tea key.
Yes, no question. Well, that'd be something. If you actually have sticky keys, there could be, hopefully one has not spilled anything
into the
keyboard.
That's probably when it happened on an older computer.
Okay.
So I had to get a newer computer and just, oh, my goodness. So, well, thank you very much.
Well, good luck.
Good luck with that. And let's take another call now. Listener on line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Yeah, my problem is I recently installed a program that has added a user. And consequently, when I log on, go to standby, I get these welcome screens, which I really, would like not to have, where it asks for a password, and I have to say, just bypass it. Can you tell me how I can rid myself of this requirement? I go to control panel and the user accounts.
Right, and there is a setting. I tell you exactly where it was, except I'm not using here in the studio a Windows XP system, so I don't have that screen here. But
right.
What you want to do is you want to, and somewhere along there, turn off simple sign-ons or turn off application sharing, something of that sort, and it will be in users and groups, and there will be a checkbox for it. Again, I wish I could tell you, but I just don't have that.
Well, I'm looking at it now, and maybe I can suggest to you what should be. And it says change the way users log on.
Oh, definitely do that one. Make the
That's
change.
That's the one, right?
Yes.
Now, if I uncheck use the welcome screen, then when I boot up, I get the inquiry about a password.
Well, which is can also... okay, so what happened? Before, you did not get that password inquiry then.
That's right.
And you would just as soon not get either the password nor the which user are you.
Exactly.
Okay, because what I was suggesting...
You, before you go on, if this will help, I don't know. When I downloaded this software, it's from... I'm a tennis referee, so I downloaded this program from USTA, and it's put something on here, which I didn't put on myself, and it says ASP.NET Machine Computer Administrator Password Protected. And since that has popped up on my user accounts, this is why my logon and standby and everything has been changed. And I don't know if this is really the question you want to ask or can't ask, but I'm afraid to. I have a choice of deleting that.
Deleting that account.
If I delete it, I won't be able to use the program. I can't seem to just turn it off, as I do. You can turn off a guest.
Right.
But you can't seem to turn this off. I have the choice of either deleting it or letting it on and getting these weird sign-on problems.
Well, I would try two things.
Okay.
First, I would go ahead and just see how things work if you change the way users sign on. Now, I know that brings up the password, but you can just essentially, it will remember the name typically, and you can, if you don't have a password, you can just press enter and go past that and see if that is a intermediate solution. Make sure that that doesn't break anything else.
Right.
If that works... and everything seems to be fine, and you can still use the software that you had downloaded.
Right.
Then you can cross your fingers and try deleting that account. Now, was this software that was this shareware? Was this software that you had to pay for, and so therefore there might be some support available for it? Or
no, it's a part of the United States Tennis Association. It is free, but it is. I have to be a member and
right.
I have to be an authorized user, which I am. But I guess I could delete it and hope that it works anyway.
Well, and chances are that you will be able to reinstall it. But here is something you should do before you try doing that.
Right.
You're running Windows XP, I presume.
I am.
And are you familiar with the Windows Restore Point feature?
I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
So before you go about deleting it, now typically any time that you install new software, a lot of software will generate a new restore point. But before you go about deleting that, in case deleting it causes any other problems, you might want to just manually set another restore point, which you can do by going into the standard restore dialog
right.
box. That's not going to guarantee that you have no problems in backing up to a prior state, but it can certainly help eliminate them. So I would try both of those.
Right. Okay. I'll do that.
And then the other thing is, since this is from the Tennis Association, the possibility exists that whoever developed that for them may be available, probably not on a toll-free call, but you could try to call them and say, I'm having a minor technical issue with this software. Is there anyone I can talk to?
Right. I think that would be a possibility.
So those are the best suggestions I can give, I think.
Right. I think that is very good, and I'll apply that. Speaking of restore, may I ask another question?
Certainly.
The easiest way for me to get to restore, well, I guess it isn't the easiest, but the way I've done it is going to search, and not search, but help and support.
Yes.
It won't load anymore.
Oh, it won't? So no. Are you able to get to it at all then, or do you have an alternate?
Not at all. I can get to, you know, restore from accessories, I think.
Right.
But I used to just click on help and support, but I just can't get it to load. I click on it, and nothing happens.
Again, I try to give you a little bit more direct advice, but I don't have restore on this particular machine that I'm using. One of the things you could try doing, if you can still get it to it from accessories, you can make it even a bit easier because you have to drill down through accessories and maintenance programs and administrative programs and all of that. But once you've got one of those and you actually see it on the menu, you can use the right mouse button and right drag it onto the desktop, which will create a shortcut. You'll have the option of creating a shortcut so that you can just double click on it on the desktop.
Oh, do you mean for restore?
Yeah, for restore.
Right.
Just a convenient way of getting to it if it's a hassle going through. In terms of why you can no longer get to it going through the help and support, that's a little bit strange. Something has gotten, some pointers have gotten changed, and I at this point don't think I could really talk you through what to do with that. But
is that an executable file that I might be able to look around for? Do you have any idea what it might be?
It probably is. Let me see. I'm not entirely sure I'll be able to give you that information, but let me see if I can find anything on Restore. Mm-hmm. And it may possibly be. I'll just give it a quick look. Yes, it is restore.exe, I think. Oh, wait a minute. Looking at the wrong version of the operating system. I believe that if you do a search for restore.exe, you can also, when you're running restore, getting it to accessories, do the Control-Alt-Delete to bring up the task manager and then look at what the running programs are, and you can see the names that way.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about the search, about the help file, help and support, which I can't load.
Oh, the entire help file?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That is... probably what you're going to need to do is help. Let's see. So you don't get any message at all. Nothing happens. It just...
Absolutely nothing.
Well, let me see if I can take a quick look at...
While Peter does that, I'll reintroduce us. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and it is the third Monday of the month, the day we talk about computers. Computers and You is what we call the show. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Kimball is our guest this afternoon. He's with the University of Illinois. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the University's Technology Consortium, FAST 3, at the Center for Teaching Excellence. If you've got a question about computers, you can give us a call this afternoon and talk to Peter. The number's 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Enough time?
Well, I wasn't able to find it. It's enough time. I won't be able to look much further.
Uh-huh.
What I would suggest, I was not able to find a specific fix for that problem. So I guess my suggestion would be to go to the program, start settings control panel, since this is a fairly basic function. Once there, you can choose add, remove programs, and once there, you can choose to fix or repair Windows programs, and you can have Windows run through and see if it thinks it's missing anything. That's my...
Yeah, I'll try that.
Yeah.
I really treasure your program. I love your new day because I never could listen the other days.
Well, glad to hear it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we talk with a listener on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I think I have a somewhat similar problem. I bought an update for OmniPage, OmniPage 15, and it ran splendidly for about 2 months, and then decided I hadn't registered it. I had. Anyway, I went through the, tried to go through the motions of registering it, but it acted as though my firewall or possibly the anti-spyware, antivirus program or the spyware programs were interfering, so I reluctantly disabled all of them and was still unable to get it to register.
It just says essentially the registration, I presume it's an online registration.
Yes, yes.
And let's see, and you said it was only page 15. My suggestion in this case, especially since you have, it's obviously a program that you pay for, so what I would suggest doing is going, now have you taken a look at the OmniPage website? Talks about online registration.
I even talked to their tech people.
Oh, okay, that was going to be my next suggestion.
I got the impression that they're having this problem rather more often than not. A little hard to understand him. I think he's probably Indian or Pakistani.
Uh-huh. A lot of companies have outsourced support. That's
mm-hmm.
true.
Actually, these people can be pretty good. But I think there's a possibility that there's a way of registering it by mail. But
And there may well be. Online registration... I'm just kind of taking a quick look at the OmniPage. What I would suggest doing is when you talk to OmniPage technical support the first time, often they will give you a case number or some sort of reference number in case
mm-hmm.
you call back.
Mm-hmm.
And I would call back and ask to speak with a supervisor saying, this is with case such and such. We're not able to resolve it. May I speak to a supervisor? Because that will be presumably at many companies a higher level of support and may well be able to address either how to get the online registration to work or what your options will be. But I think at this point you're probably stuck trying to work through the folks at OmniPage. But try asking for a supervisor.
I'll do that. Thanks so much.
Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Good
Bye.
Luck. Bye-bye. Next we talk with a listener on line two. Hi, you're on the air with Peter Kimball.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoy listening to your show.
Great, thank you.
I think a simpler question, I hope. I'm trying to set up my computer at home so I can use another computer remotely. And I'm wondering if I can also set it up so I can use my printer remotely as well. In other words, sitting in another room.
Okay, so what you essentially are wanting to do is build what's called a home network then.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And you already have
I can already use my computer. I've set it up so I can use my computer and get to the internet.
Okay.
I'd like to be able to print while I'm sitting watching a basketball game, print out something, and that's what I'm getting stuck on.
So you have a machine, a computer that's up wherever your network connection is, and the printer is up there, and you've got a second machine that you would now like to be able to print to the printer that's connected to your first machine.
Yeah.
What you need to do is on the first machine, and I presume you're using Windows.
Yes.
Okay. Windows XP?
Yes.
Probably. What you need to do is go up to the Start menu, Settings, and go to Printers. And from there, you will find the printers that are listed. And what you need to do, you can typically either right-click on whichever printer that is connected. It'll show you the various printers. It'll show you some fairly odd things like, you know, fax machines and such.
Well, you know, I went to there, and it doesn't have my printer listed. I have just an HP, you know, what I thought was a common printer, but when I go to this list of printers, it's not there.
Well, now, on your machine that's by the printer, presumably on that machine, the printer will be there. So I'm talking...
It is there.
You're okay. Right. And so on that, what you'll need to do is find that particular printer, mm-hmm. And then you can right-click on it, or perhaps you can double-click on it, I'm not sure, and there is an option to turn on sharing. So
yeah,
you
and
click
I've
on
done
the
that.
Share. And
yeah,
you
I've
choose shared as, and you give whatever the name is going to be. And once you've got that shared, and depending on what you're doing, and again, I'm looking at an older version here, you keep track of what the name is. And then on your current, on your new machine, the machine that you want to be able to print from remotely, when you say that you want to add a printer, one of the choices is going to be whether the printer is going to be a network printer or a local printer.
Uh-huh.
And you'll choose network printer at that point.
Okay.
And then you can try finding a printer in the directory, which...
And I can't.
Okay, so it doesn't show up in the directory. So then what you're going to need to do is you're going to need, and again, I wish I had the same screen up here, check on your machine upstairs. You can right-click on the My Computer icon and determine what the name of that machine is. It'll have a computer name. It might be, you know, My Computer, it might be Sam, it might be George, whatever you named the thing initially.
Yeah.
And then you can specify that machine name by typing for the printer name a pair of backslashes, whatever that machine name is, and then the printer name that you've assigned, and see if it can find it that way.
Okay, I haven't tried that.
That's the way of referring within... and the other possibility, let's see, connect on the or your intranet, so you won't have a URL for this, but the that would be to try to type, and again, if I had exactly the same screen up here, I'd be able to give you a little bit more cogent advice, but you specify the name of the machine with two slashes in front of it, backslashes, that tells you that it is a, tells the computer that you're referring to a machine name, a slash, and then the name of the actual printer.
Okay.
There is another option. That I have used in other areas, because this option does require that, of course, your computer upstairs or wherever it is—I'm assuming upstairs because you know it's wherever the printer is—is on, and it has to be on because it's the one that's talking to the printer.
Yeah.
I presume that you also have, I gather, a wireless access point, kind of a wireless router. That's how you can use this from downstairs.
Yeah, I have a wireless router.
Okay. And you know, it's from any number of companies. But one of the things that you can do is you can, for relatively low cost, we're looking at $30, $40 probably, is get a printer, essentially a print server. Linksys and various other companies make them. And that simply, the printer plugs into that. That printer print server plugs into one of your presumably four ports on your routers, so that essentially, as far as a network is concerned, you'll have your main computer plugged into it, and you'll have this print server plugged into it. And depending on which brand of print server you get, they'll come with software that you will now need to load both on your laptop and on your main machine, because the main machine is no longer going to have the printer connected directly to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the upside of that is you can now print to that machine, print to the printer, whether or not the upstairs machine is on, whether it's busy doing other things, whether it's crashed.
Okay.
And so that's essentially a printer server, and it'll probably be a box that looks a lot like your current wireless router. And again, they're very inexpensive.
Okay.
But you do have to install the software that comes with them on both on every machine that you want to be able to print to. And the procedure is not that difficult, but you just have to pay attention to a few details.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
That's very helpful.
Well, good luck. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Kimball is with us this afternoon. Peter is with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. In this program, Computers and You, this is a show we do once a month on the third Monday of the month here on the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take another call, a listener on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi, Peter.
Yes.
Actually, I have a remark and a question. The previous caller that was having the printer problems.
Yes.
I had some problems kind of like that a while back, and it was just kind of relative to two computers being able to find files and printers on one another. And none of the obvious things worked, and it turned out that what my problem was firewall settings.
Oh, yes, that's true. And I'm so used to having mine set to pass the printer through that I should have mentioned that to the prior caller. So thank you very much for bringing that.
Yeah, I had tightened it down to the point that none of the messages would go back and forth between the two machines.
Yes, so under Windows Firewall, which again I can't check here, just both to kind of confirm what you were saying and also for the use of the last caller, you need to make sure that under Windows Firewall you take a look and allow, there are various options, and it's pretty clear once you're looking at it, to allow the printer messages and such to go through. Thank you.
Okay, and then the question. There seems to be wireless lots of stuff these days. Is there any concept of a wireless monitor?
I have not heard of any, and one reason is because there is so much information that has to be sent to the monitor. There's an incredible, especially with a large monitor, there is so much information having to be sent so quickly that I doubt that wireless monitors are coming anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
A keyboard, no problem. You can't
right.
really do very much on that. A mouse, likewise, not much of a problem. A printer, very slow compared to the kinds of things. But imagine what would have to happen if you were going to be showing video or something on your monitor. Now, you can stream video over the internet, but the monitor has to be constantly updated. So I wouldn't look for a wireless monitor anytime soon. I'm unaware of any or of any plans for such. That doesn't mean that, you know, somebody's not working on it or there's something out there, but I'd be very surprised. And it's because of the vast amount of information.
I would have thought that maybe 54 megabit and 108 megabit wireless LANs would be enough bandwidth for it these days, but haven't seen anything that looked like it actually would accomplish that.
Well, one of the telling features of that is that a number of the high-end companies doing graphic adapters have even as much as 512 megabytes or more of video RAM dedicated just to being able to process information, to be able to send it out to the screen at a rate of 30 full screens per second.
Yeah.
And some of them are going to be, and that's actually standard video, actually, when you look at the tremendous number, I haven't done the mathematics on it, but I would guess that if you calculated it, you would be looking at bandwidths of several million bits per second necessary.
Yeah, it would be high.
So that's I suspect, why you're not seeing that. What some people have done, and certainly Apple is among these, make it kind of look wireless. You've got the monitor with the computer built into it, flat screen, and there it is. Of course,
uh-huh.
The downside of that is if the monitor fails, you have to ship off your whole computer rather than replace the monitor.
And, of course, what I'm thinking about is here is your nice, brand-new 60-inch high-definition TV screen. And wouldn't it be fun if you could sit there with your laptop using that as the monitor from across the room without wires?
Well, there is a route around that. You could certainly be using the keyboard from your monitor, from your laptop, and send that through a computer that would be wired as part of the audio-video system.
Mm-hmm.
But also keep in mind that with the exception of some of the very high-end, high-definition television sets, most of them do not have the same resolution that you're going to have even on a laptop of recent vintage, as witnessed by the fact that you never can, unless you've got very high-definition television set, read the credits at the end of movies.
Oh, well.
Yes, it's a nice thought. But
good thought.
Yeah, well, we'll wait another decade.
Yes, I think by the time the 2010s roll around, we're going to be seeing all sorts of convergence. But I think you'd be literally past the bleeding edge at the moment.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you very much.
Quite
Thanks
welcome.
For the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited. No one waiting at the moment. If you'd like to talk with Peter Kimball, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL and 333-WILL. Internet telephones and internet telephone service. Speaking of things we'd like to have and like to have work better, where are we? Where are we headed?
Well, it is a lot better now than it was a few years ago. The problem with internet telephony, or sometimes referred to as voice over IP or VoIP, I don't know if anybody pronounces it that way, but I tend to because it just always looked like a weird acronym to me.
VoIP.
Yes, there is no reason that you shouldn't be able to do that. The problem, of course, is unless you've got a very reliable connection between the two ends, so the network is not slow, etc., you can end up with the sound quality being very questionable. It can either be sounding muffled or words or little bits of time where you've got a dropout. And so many improvements are being made. A lot of cell phones are, of course, internet capable, but that's not the same as voice over internet. You're still using the cell phone to communicate through the cellular company's network, so you get good voice connection. They are also adding web access to those cell phones, and of course, there was the big splash a month or two ago with Apple's announcement of their forthcoming iPhone. But that's not really going to be voice over internet. That is still going to be a cellular telephone. Voice over internet generally is going to work much better if you are, and a lot of people use it, especially for calling overseas, because you can do it for practically free if you've got a network connection at both ends. So there'll be a lot of improvements in that area, but so far the voice over internet, I've had a number of people, one or two at least, which is, I guess, a number, say that, my phone will now do, you know, it's all internet-based. Well, no, it's still a telephone, and it's just also doing some internet web browsing and emailing and that sort of thing.
Okay, let's take another call. Listener on line one. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Fine,
good,
how are
you?
Just fine. I had a couple of comments and a question. The first was on VoIP. I have experience with that, and the sound quality, as you say, is pretty poor, but also, depending on what you're looking for, reliability can be an issue. A couple of times we've had the internet go out because some node somewhere in Indiana crashed because of lightning or something, and, you know, you can lose phone service, so it's not something I would recommend as a permanent or even primary communication solution.
That's a good point, because when the power goes out, when the internet goes down, you're doomed.
Exactly. My question is, I've heard of something called Internet 2 or something of that nature. There's supposed to be some sort of backbone forming that's going to be 10 times as fast. That's just a number I heard. Can you elaborate on that and what's going on with that?
Well, Internet 2 is indeed a much faster, 10 or perhaps 100 times faster than the original backbone. It is in full operation now. It is not designed for and is not currently available for run-of-the-mill users, so there's no way that you can currently say, oh, I'd like to sign up for Internet 2 access. A lot of educational and other institutions are using it. Back in the days of the original Internet, and as it was being developed, the National Science Foundation was paying for a lot of the behind-the-scenes infrastructure, all the communication links and such. That was turned over to commercial telecommunications companies in the mid to late 90s, which led to the commercialization and the tremendous surge in Internet usage. In the meantime, National Science Foundation is now working on the much faster Internet 2, Well, not working on it. They're continuing to improve it. The University of Illinois, for example, has a number of locations. It allows such things as real-time video conferencing over the Internet without the jerky lags that you would see over standard Internet. To find out more about it, if you'd like to get a lot of detailed information, you might want to just check their website, which is www.internet2.edu. Which will tell you all kinds of things, but my cautionary note is don't get too excited about having this at home anytime soon.
Well, I figure the military or whoever is probably kind of keeping it for themselves for the time being will probably get Internet 2 when they're working on Internet 3.
Well, and the other thing that's going to be necessary for home use of Internet 2 is there's going to be have to be a much faster connection all the way to the endpoint, all the way to the home. So it's that last half mile or that mile. Internet 2 would certainly be quite possible as soon as, well, there are a number of financial and other issues, but as soon as there is, for example, fiber to the home, if the fiber optic comes all the way to the home, then you don't have any bottlenecks to speak of that would prevent those higher speeds. But even if Internet 2 were available by subscription to anyone, which it's not, most people's connections wouldn't really support it. DSL line wouldn't support it. You could not make full use of it on the cable modem systems that are out there these days.
Yeah, I was concerned when, as you were talking, it occurred to me that maybe any one person, but perhaps, you know, we would hearken back to the days of party line telephones. Maybe you have a party line Internet 2 connection. But anyway, thank you very much and have a nice day.
Yes, thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I was calling about viewing the video on TV. I've seen media players now that claim to be able to do that with TV and home movies, perhaps, and sound. Let's see, I think Netgear in particular has something like that.
Right, and D-Link and various others have that as well. And what it is, and I have not tested any of this, so I've not really played with it directly, but it is using a relatively higher speed home network. It's the higher speed than most people use. It's what's the numeric value behind it is 802.11G, the G being a faster version than what most people are using, which is 802.11B. And it can actually connect to all sorts of devices, component videos and systems and television sets if they have the appropriate inputs. I can't really tell you how well they work because they get tremendous play from their manufacturers, and a number of people are very enthusiastic about them. So I guess I would suggest for more information is to try doing a Google search for things like media player, TV, you know, include all of those, and you'll find all sorts of lists. They are not that expensive. I'm not quite sure if I can find a price for this particular one. I'm not finding it here. But certainly it is the direction in which many, many companies are trying to move. Microsoft, Apple, and many of the others would like to have just a single source solution. It is your computer. It is your media center. It is going to get your audio. It's going to get your downloads. It's going to do practically everything for you.
Except the dishes, probably.
Except the dishes, perhaps, yes. And eventually, the goal is, and this is going to happen, but it's not going to happen this year or next, is to make that as seamless and easy to use as the television set itself, as doing a simple search and clicking. And they're moving in that direction. I'm taking a look here. One of the devices does the not only the MP3 audio, but it does MPEG 1, 2, and 4 video, which is fairly high level. So it does all sorts of various things. Yes, it is available now. To make use of it, of course, to make practical use of it, you would want to have a fast Internet connection because it's not going to be much fun unless you've got a, you know, presumably a cable modem or a fast DSL line.
But
they're available now. They're relatively reliable, and I don't know how expensive they are, but they're not that much. Perhaps I'm not even going to guess, but I am going to guess. Probably do fairly well for a couple $100, but that's just a guess. I could be way off on that because I haven't really considered buying one yet.
What was the name of that network? 802.
Oh, it's simply the way in which these things often communicate with one another. The standard original home networking protocols and rules were all under the number that it was assigned by the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers, or IEEE, and that was the 802.11 standard. So original home networks all used 802 wireless, used 802.11b. A little bit later, 802.11a came out, which was actually faster, but came out a little bit, you know, it had been worked on earlier, so the letters are a little bit peculiar. The one that you would need to have that most of the media players use, to my knowledge, is 802.11. There's a decimal point there. G, as in George.
G.
But okay. You don't have to worry about that. That's going to be pretty much transparent to you. That's going to be included in the hardware if you do get one of these media centers.
Okay, so I don't have to have a router that is that fast?
No. What you're going to need to do, well, that's a good question. What you will need is you will need to have a router of some sort. It should be 802. What I would suggest is, if you're interested in this, is in more detail and are seriously considering it, check the webs for the references that I'd given before. You'll find two or three different companies. Linksys is one. D-Link is another. There are no doubt many others. And you'll find the information and what it requires. For example, you need to have the media player and you need to have a wireless router that is compatible with it, such as using 802.11g. And that should be indicated on any of these companies' websites. But yes, you will need to have a wireless network that is compatible.
Okay. So I may have to upgrade my router as well.
Quite possibly, especially if it's an older one. The older ones that simply, now it'd have to be quite a bit older probably, but the older ones, which are just 802.11b, would almost certainly not be fast enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's not one thing, it's several, of course, whenever you upgrade.
Yes. Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Kimball, our guest this month for Computers in You. No one waiting at the moment. We have about a minute and a half left. Anything you want to leave us with?
I always like to leave people with an eye towards safety, and we've talked about that many times before. One of the things that is happening more and more are the fake web pages that try to entice you into giving some information. And one of the problems that a number of web search engines are dealing with, Google and all the rest, Yahoo, MSN, are some of these scammers and cyber criminals are getting legitimate-looking web pages that end up being listed when you do a search, because it's not always obvious to Google and the others that these are for nefarious purposes. So you just need to be very careful as you are saying, oh, well, I found it on Google, so I'll click on it. And anything that starts asking you for information that you make feel a little bit uncomfortable, it should never ask you for your social security number, for your bank account number, for your firstborn child, and whatever else it may be. If it seems to be a little bit too prying, it probably is.
One last question in this regard. You're out and about with your laptop and you're using Wi-Fi somewhere. How do you know the connection is secure? How do you know you're not dealing with an evil twin?
Well, you generally don't.
Wow, okay.
You are unlikely to in most places, because in most places it probably wouldn't be worth setting up the evil twin. The evil twin is another wireless area that you think you're, for example, hooking to the wireless network in your coffee shop, but you're actually hooking to the wireless network being run by somebody next door who's watching everything that goes by. One thing you can help ensure your safety with is whenever you're using a public access spot, make sure that you are only using encrypted connections. That helps. It's not perfect because, of course, they're in control of some of that and they could be telling you that it's encrypted and not, but that's certainly one thing to do.
Okay.
And the other is to avoid putting sensitive information, typing it when you're off at some of these wireless access points.
Very good. Well, thanks once again for joining us. Good to see you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure, as always.
And we'll see you in May.
Yes, and spring really will be here by then.
Okay. And next month, April, third Monday of the month, Greg Klein will be with us for this program, Computers and You. Again, our thanks this afternoon to Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the University's Technology Consortium, FAST-3, at the Center for Teaching Excellence.